Some of you know about golf. Some of you play golf. How many play golf? Golfers in here? Yeah. Okay, you're going to resonate with this. I am absolutely, I'm a terrible golfer. My dad was really great, and he willed to me the great legacy of his clubs. That's all I got was the clubs, no skill, no talent at it. But I do enjoy it. It's fun to be outside and see all that. And I heard a story of some golfers who were watching this one guy, and he really was having a bad day. Just every shot flubbed, you know, mulligans everywhere. It was a terrible day for him. And finally, he got to this one water trap, and I don't know what it is about Florida water traps, but they have eaten more of my golf balls than I can tell you. They just like suck them in, you know. Anyway, it could be over in another field. It could be in another course, and my ball will go over there somehow. Anyway, but he's hitting it, and ball after ball is going into this thing. He was getting so frustrated, couldn't get over the water. So you could just tell he was just seething, and the other golfers are kind of like, well, I wonder what he's going to do. What's he going to do? This guy's terrible. He's terrible. So the golfer picks up his clubs. He walks over to the water, the whole bag, and he swings them over his head like this, and he launches them out into the water and stomps off. And all of the other golfers like, wow, that was pretty extreme, but I guess he's giving up golf for a while. A couple of minutes later, the golfer comes back, and he walks out into the water, and he gets up to about his waist or so, and he pulls his bag out, and the golfers are all thinking, well, he's come to his senses. This makes sense. You know, it's kind of stupid to throw your clubs away and all of that. And then the golfer reaches into the back of the bag and zips it, takes out his car keys, and then takes the clubs and throws them even further. Now, you don't have to be a golfer to understand the frustration with that. Everybody has a bad day, times when you get angry and frustrated, you're at your wit's end. But what happens when you allow that to dominate your life? What happens when those feelings are brought not just into your home, but into your church as well? Leslie Parrott, in his book, The Habit of Happiness, tells about a woman in a church that he once served who sat on the south side of the balcony right by the thermostat. In every service, the ushers were instructed to adjust the thermostat to make her happy. Whether it would be hotter or colder or whatever, it didn't matter because she was so obnoxious about her request that he thought maybe what they should do without saying a word is to disconnect that thermostat and put another one on another part of the church. And now, where's Helen James's daughter? You were here. There you are. Okay, I got to tell you. Okay, this is an old friend from Auburndale when I was there. And Helen James used to do that to me. She would, that's too hot, it's too cold, it's too hot, too cold. And we got a new air conditioner. And the thermostat was different. And they put it in a different part of the church. I never told Helen. Never did. God bless her. She was such a sweet lady, and she was a remarkable character and all that. But that's one thing I remember is that she, every service, I'd go see her back there, and she'd be flipping it back and forth and whatever. And, you know, I said, was it nice after you adjusted it? Did it get okay? And she said, it was just fine, George. It was just fine. But good for you, Helen. That's great. But there are a lot of other things that this lady in Parrott's story did not like. She didn't like the hymns. They were either too fast or too slow, too loud or too soft. Whenever he preached a theological sermon, she would say that it was too heavy. If he preached some sort of an updated, energetic thing, then it was being modernist. And it was difficult. She would take her children out of children's church and out of Sunday school on a pretty regular basis because she didn't think the people there did right. And more than once, he knelt at the chancel of the church with no one around, and he just prayed. He prayed for help to deal with this lady like everyone else, but still, she rejected his love. She rejected his concern, and the situation seemed hopeless. No matter what he did, he couldn't get through to her. Well, that happens, doesn't it? It happens in churches too often. I mean, let's face it, not all church people are lovable. Of course, this doesn't apply to us. It doesn't apply to you. You know, it's that other church down the street, or remember that church you used to belong to. Yeah, that one, that's the one that was the problem. But the reality is, when you deal with issues of getting rid of weeds, you're really talking about issues that are better dealt with while things are good. Now, I've been here for 7 months, and I have loved every moment of it. And I am so impressed and so blessed that this church is so conflict-free. I mean, but I'm always reminded of what happened in Auburndale when we bought a house and all of a sudden crabgrass was growing in our yard. And I don't mean a little bit of crabgrass. I mean huge clumps of crabgrass. And I went to the guy that sprayed our yard and I said, "What's going on?" He said, "I don't know. I'm spraying it on a regular basis." Well, it turned out later on his company had to admit that he was selling the chemicals and all he was spraying on our yard was, I don't know, some water or something like that. It was useless. So all the crabgrass was going up like crazy. But I had to get out there and dig it up by hand. And I kept thinking, you know, if we could have dealt with this a long time ago, it would have been a little clump in one hand pull up. And so within the life of the church, every year or so, I preach a series of sermons about getting rid of the weeds, so that we can do the weeding before they actually start to grow, to remind ourselves why we are blessed as a church with so little conflict, how we get rid of the weeds so that when we live together, we can live together in harmony so that we can live together in peace. A highly esteemed Bible teacher, Dr. Howard Hendricks, said something quite interesting some time back. Let me quote him. He said, "From research and personal experience, I've come to the conclusion that in every church, 16% of the members will never change. The tragedy is I see young pastors every day leaving the ministry because of that 16%. I share that. I've seen that happen. It's as if they're butting their heads against a brick wall. What they should be doing is concerning themselves and concentrating on the 84% who are ripe for change. That's where the real ministry of the local church takes place." And he's right. It's easy to be intimidated by that 16%. We might call them the weeds in the church, and forget the vast bouquet of flowers that makes up the real church. We would like to think that because we are Christians, the church is immune somehow to personality conflicts, hurt feelings, and just plain old orneriness. We would like to think that we live on some sort of a higher plane, but unfortunately, we don't. There's an amusing story in the New York Times Magazine last year. It was about a Japanese woman who was recounting a meeting with a man whom she abruptly described using the English word jerk. He's a jerk. And the person writing the story said, "Well, how do you say jerk in Japanese?" And she says, "You can't. We don't have a word in Japanese for that." She said, "We have to use the English word. It's not as if there are no jerks in Japan, but the Japanese language is not made for sniping at people." Guess what Japanese drivers say to each other after a car accident? Immediately they say, "I am sorry. I am sorry." The Japanese language is simply not designed for hurling invectives at one another. And Deborah and I had an opportunity to be in China just a few months ago, and their language is beautiful, and we learned a lot of words. But one of the things we discovered is that in China, they have that same lack of invectives in their language. If they want to dismiss one of their enemies, if they want to call them something, they call them, let's get it right, titsuloi, titsuloi, which means baby bunny rabbit. I kind of like that. Baby bunny rabbit. I mean, somebody comes after you and they're just being a pain and some furious man's running up to you and he's like, "You baby bunny rabbit." Like, oh, wow. Well, there's a lesson here for us. We'd like to think that people who have been baptized would no longer even have the vocabulary of ugliness to say hurtful things to one another. You think that that ugly part of our character would have been washed away with our sins. You would think that a fellowship that was formed around God's love would never have to worry about weeds growing in the garden. But you and I know that too often that's not so. Hurtful things get said sometimes, and unloving actions do occur, and relationships, even within the church, can turn sour. But of course, weeds in the church are really just a symptom of weeds in our individual hearts. I mean, we bring ourselves into this place. There's no such thing as a perfect church because churches are not made up of perfect people. A few moments ago, I mentioned about Leslie Parrott's story of this woman in his church who was never happy. But there was a lot more to that story. One day, he was visiting with her in her home, and she let down her guard. And she started to tell him in a mellow moment in her personality her story. She had a severely handicapped child whom she had kept secreted away because of her guilt and her embarrassment. The jolt in her life had made her more severe by her belief that God had somehow sent her this child as a punishment for her sexual sins before she was married. As a result, the mother projected all of her hurt and all of her frustrations on every safe target in her life, including her church. And after she shared her guilt, though, she changed. After she shared her secret with her pastor, she never bugged him again. He was never bugged by her because now he understood her, understood where she was coming from. Isn't that one of the critical things that we do here? That this is a place where weeds and flowers can come. And deep in my heart, I know that this is the only place where weeds can come and be truly changed. You notice that Jesus said to allow the weeds and the good crop to grow together. It would have been possible to try to pluck out the weeds if you like. But isn't it a good thing that in a setting like this and in a church like this, that's not what we do. We allow everyone to come into this place, to experience this fellowship, to be touched by God's Spirit without coming through and saying, okay, well, let's see now, what have you been doing lately that we want to know about? So maybe you're not welcome to come here. Weeds in the church are a result of weeds in the individual person's hearts. But the church is the place where that individual heart can be healed and changed. Peter Goins, in his book of sermons, he said, at Pentecost, diversity was overcome by a power that transcended it. The power to understand, to hear in one's own language, one's own accent, one's own regional dialect, the wonderful words of God. The gift of understanding did not diminish the diversity and the authenticity of the people who were just beginning to understand. People did not cease to be Medes or Persians or Elamites. They were not reduced to some vague generality without a past or a place. They did not become less than they were, but they became more than they had ever been before, for they became at one with all those who heard and understand that God was alive and active in this world. Now, we become more than what we are when we gather together as the people of God, when we are in the community. And that is one of my favorite words this year, community, where we gather as the community of faith, the First Presbyterian Church. And here's where the problem can occur. We can become attached to the weeds in our hearts. We don't really want them changed. We don't really want them uprooted. We revel sometimes in our anger, in our bitterness, in our being lost. But if we are to be all that God calls us to be, we have to surrender those things to God's pruning power. And sometimes they're our most treasured weeds. My vision of the church is a place where people are challenged to do just that, where we worship regularly, serve eagerly, give generously, and live worthily, to seek to be more than we are, to turn our weeds into wildflowers. And many people come to this church like Robert Frost described in his poem, Death of a Hired Hand. Frost described a man named Silas in his poem this way. Listen to what he said. He had nothing to look backward to with pride and nothing to look forward to with hope. He had nothing to look backward to with pride and nothing to look forward to with hope. People come into this sanctuary every Sunday who are broken, with nothing to look backward to with pride and nothing to look forward to with hope, and this is the best place for them to be. The church is still the one familiar landmark where the weary traveler can knock on the door at midnight and ask for some bread. There's a deep longing for that bread of hope and a deep longing for that bread of love. At the terrible midnight of the war and chaos in this world, there is a deep longing for the bread of peace. Who said that? Martin Luther King Jr. said that. At the terrible midnight of the war and chaos of this world, there is a deep longing for the bread of peace. The church is the only place that can provide that. Somebody asked me one time, when are you going to speak on what the strategy of the church is going to be over the next decade or so? Well, I will. The time is coming, and sort of letting it dribble out a little bit. It's the same that it has been from day one, 20 centuries ago, though. The strategy of the church, and all that time, has been a very simple strategy. Tell the story of what Jesus has meant to you and invite people to come and join in that journey. Now, we haven't been that great about that as Presbyterians. Sometimes Presbyterians are almost conscientious objectors when it comes to inviting people. You're not. I mean, not, something like 60% of the people that come here are visitors that are coming with other people or invited by other people, and that is great. But just think about that. To invite, that is our strategy for the future. And we have not been all that great about that as a denomination. We are losing in a world that is hungry for spiritual things. We're losing in a world that is looking for the, quote, good old days. Well, let me tell you, folks, they weren't so good. If you look at the golden days of the church, as one comment that I heard, the golden days of Presbyterian was back when, whatever, and they will tell something about that. Well, I tell you, I've done some research. I've gone back into the session minutes, and it wasn't so great. There were still problems with finances, still problems with staff. There were still problems with the building falling down. There were still problems with the organ. It never stops, and that's okay. It's all right. But there really wasn't a golden era of the church, a golden days of the church. We still struggle to find Sunday school teachers. And there was conflict that dogged the steps of this church. Session meetings used to be 3 or 4 hours long on a regular basis. We had one this past week, wasn't it? It was the 2 hours. It was the longest one I've ever been to, and we got stuff done, and it was good. But we're never doing that again if I can help it, because I'll tell you, I came home, and Deborah looked at me, and she said, just sit down. Just sit down. I can tell it was a good meeting, but wow, a lot of time. Because we had a lot of work done, but it wasn't a lot of conflict. It wasn't any conflict. But you see, our heritage in this church is one of faithfulness and compassion. In spite of all of our weeds that may occur here, God has done mighty things with this church and continues to do mighty things here. Every day there are ministries and activities. There's a constant barrage of critical outreach and pastoral care that takes place because of this church. The harmony, the melody, the rhythm of joy sing throughout this building every week. It's why I keep coming back day after day, and why I suspect that you keep coming back too. There are wonderful things that go on here, and they are present, the present of this church. It's not the golden days. It's not the future. It's right now. These things are happening right now in all areas of our ministry, weeds and all. We're still intentional about our task and making an impact on the community as God's people. The future of this church is simply this. We will tell the story of what Jesus Christ has meant to us and invite people to come and join us on that journey. Any church that loses that intention, that focus, will die. It's like a body making up its mind not to breathe anymore. It will die. A Methodist bishop recently said the reason that people don't invite other people to church is because they fear rejection. We're afraid that the person that you say, hey, Becky, why don't you come to church with me on Sunday? She'll say, are you kidding? Have you heard George Head preach? I would be caught dead there. But you know, that's not what happens. Because they say, terrific, I want to go. But we fear that people are going to reject us. We have the assumption that everybody has a church home. Let me tell you that in this community, 31% are unchurched. No church at all, no engagement at all. That's millions and millions of people across the country with no engagement at all. Come weal or woe, the status is quo. That's what churches say. We're just going to keep the course. We don't need any more members. I mean, after all, I might lose my parking space. Yes. But Jesus Christ called us to share our story. And before any of you start to write me articles about why it's better to be spiritual than to be growing, let me assure you that I believe that if we are spiritual, if we look after the things of God and seek to grow our faith, people will see that and be like the little moth in the bug's life, you know, the one whose friends say, don't go into the light, don't go into the light. And the little bug says, but it's so beautiful, but it's so beautiful. It's not about numbers, it's about people, hurting, lost, lonely people, desperately seeking the health and healing that we too often take for granted. And we come and we eat this up and we go off and we don't tell anybody. I heard recently somebody commenting on the loss of members in their denomination, and you know all of the mainline denominations are struggling because we just don't seem to be able to invite very much or to show people what happens here. They said, well, it's not so bad. The Methodists lost 38,000 members last year. What? Have I missed something? There is some sort of race to see who can empty their pews faster than everybody else? Is there some sort of thing to be so unfaithful to the great commandment that we are to go out and to share the gospel with people? Never forget that we are called to tell the story of what Christ has meant for you and invite people to join you in that journey. Never forget. A little girl was over in the corner one day. She was scribbling furiously, and she was just doing all kinds of things with the crayons. Mom came over and said, what are you doing? She said, I'm drawing a picture of God. And the mom said, well, nobody knows what God looks like. She says, well, I'm not done with my picture yet. But you see, that's our job, to show the world a picture of what God is like as God works in and through and changing us week after week, from weeds to wildflowers, and to invite people to join us as God's will comes to pass here at First Presbyterian Church. Now, next time that I preach, I will be continuing this. It's actually got four of these in row, so you'll be able to keep up with it. Next week, we talk about tools. How do we gather tools together to get rid of the weeds? And the first one, I'll give you a hint, is prayer. So we'll talk about that. Let us bow our heads. Father, we thank you that in times of trouble and times of triumph, you are here with us. And we realize that we're all weeds sometimes, and we're all wildflowers other times. And we recognize that. And all of us, we come into this place just as we are. And then you look at us, and you say, you are my beloved child, and I love you. Help us to embrace that reality, and then to share that with a world that does not understand it and does not experience it. We ask this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.